Good morning, everybody. Yesterday we were running a bit late, and so they thought they would have today, they would have a Swiss running the session. So I'm from Switzerland, so that we can actually keep very strict timing here. So I have the great pleasure today of introducing our first speaker, Claire Tomlin. She has a Bachelor in Electrical Engineering from Waterloo University in Canada, a Master's degree in Electrical Engineering also from Imperial College in London, and a PhD in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science from the University of California at Berkeley. She is also a MacArthur Fellow, which is sometimes nicknamed the Genius Award for young researchers in the United States. Currently, she is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at the university at UC Berkeley, and she's a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University at the same time. Her research interests are in system science, stochastic hybrid dynamics, avionics, and flight control, and specifically relevant for today's talk, she has been applying her ideas to systems biology, and she has been cooperating with the people at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And today, she will be talking about mathematical models to help understand developmental biology and cancer. Claire, we're very much looking forward to your presentation. The floor is yours.
Yeah.
No,
no, this is blank. I won't be able to see it.
Why is it blank?
Because it doesn't work on the computer. That's what I said before. So
you and the guide to start it.
Yeah, so just bring it up. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a honor to be invited to give a talk in this forum. And I'm going to talk today about a project that I've been working on now for a number of years, which involves kind of reverse engineering of biological cell networks. We'd like to try to use our expertise in engineering, specifically in control theory and mathematical modeling, to try to help understand particular biological circuits that, I'm working with a number of biologists, but I think are of great interest to biology as a whole. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of background, and then I'm going to present three short stories of different biological systems that we've worked on. And the main project that we're working on now is a project in breast cancer. It's joint with the Karolinska Institute, but the results that I'm going to present today are joint with our collaborators at Lawrence Berkeley Labs and at the University of California, San Francisco. So specifically, Joe Gray and Mark Moasser. Okay, so this is not a biological, well, I guess you could say it's a biological system, but it's a system that I've been working on for a number of years, the air transportation system. This is a snapshot of aircraft across the United States at a particular instant, and then a movie showing the aircraft, high-altitude aircraft, coming in and out of the San Francisco Bay Area over a certain period of time. So I've been working for a number of years in designing automation techniques for air traffic control, for automated collision avoidance systems. We work with NASA and the FAA. We've implemented our systems on Boeing aircraft, and they've been tested out. So I'm sort of coming from a background of engineering and technology with a feeling of, given a system, one first should develop a mathematical model of that system and then go from there. So in terms of this, so let's go back to honing in on one particular aircraft. This is a very sort of stylized diagram of a Boeing 747, and this is the kind of mathematical model we might build for the longitudinal, so the vertical control of that aircraft. We have a model in which the inputs to the system are the elevator and the throttle, the outputs are the velocities, the forward, vertical, the pitch angle, and the pitch rate. So we represent those. And then we can do some experiments on this system. If we didn't know the model of the system, we could try to perturb some of those inputs. So, for example, in this model, if you don't put any control system in here, and you perturb the elevator, so these are the elevators in the back of the aircraft, and you just put a little input there, you might get some kind of oscillatory behavior. So this is what we call open loop effects. There's no control system operating. And the open loop behavior here is in the forward velocity. That's kind of an uncomfortable feeling if you were actually flying in that aircraft, because the forward velocity is oscillating around some nominal operating point. So what's typically done then, and this is how modern aircraft control systems are designed, is that you use feedback. You measure the output, and then you use that to automatically regulate the input so that you get a desired output. And so here, this is in its very simplest form, you measure the velocity, or you feed it back through some, say, proportional control, and you use that in combination with your input to modulate what actually goes into the aircraft. And in this system, you know, I'm using a very standard model of the longitudinal dynamics, that results in some achievement of a new velocity, say a new desired velocity. And in actual fact, you'd do something like this, in which you have a desired, say for altitude control, desired altitude through some feed-forward control, and then the feedback involves sensors and controllers, and it's a multi-input, multi-output control system. So this is something that we do all the time as control theorists. And in fact, we think so much about this that rather than think of that as in terms of the actual variables, we're typically modeling them with fairly standard, simple models. So this is the mathematical model that I was using, and that if you look at those dynamics, so the eigenvalues of that dynamics matrix, it will tell you exactly how the aircraft or the model of the aircraft would behave. So the typical thing we would do is develop a model. We would ask, by looking at the mathematics of that system, whether the system is stable, whether it's robust to perturbations. Okay, so now let's move over into the realm of biology. And for me, this was about 10 or 12 years ago. I was working at Stanford and at a meeting with a bunch of biologists, and I was telling them basically the story that I just presented, what I typically do, what a control theorist works on. And they said, you know, we could really use somebody like you to try to represent in equations the kinds of hypotheses we have about the biological systems, because they're nothing more than dynamic systems. They're different kinds of dynamics, but if we had a way to represent their dynamics and analyze them, we might better understand them and then hopefully think about, in the case of diseases, for example, different treatments that could be applied. Okay. So this is the start of three short stories that I'm going to tell. The first two are about development, and the third is about cancer. So the first two are systems, well, actually all three are systems that I've worked on, but they kind of increase in complexity. So I'm going to present the first one in a little more detail to illustrate the methodology. And then for the second two, I'll show you how that methodology can be extended to these more complex systems. Okay, so this is a little frog. It's called a Xenopus. It's a South African claw-toed frog. And that's its full-grown state. When it's an embryo, or at a certain stage of its embryonic development here, it's basically an embryo. We can think of this as a sphere. It's not a sphere, but we can think of it as a sphere. And we're interested in the cell differentiation process at a particular stage of the embryonic development. So here's the embryo, and you can see that the cells on the epithelium, on the skin of this embryo, are there's some dark spots amidst some lighter spots. So the dark spots are actually cells that grow little hairs at a particular stage in development, and that's very important for the embryo. The hairs help for, usually these embryos are embedded at the bottom of streams, and the hairs help to move the nutrients over the body of the embryo, and the smooth cells absorb the nutrients. And they're situated in a pattern amidst the smooth cells that don't have any hairs. And biologists have studied this system for a while, and they have determined that the patterning of the hairy cells amongst the smooth cells follows a specific pattern. So here the red cells in my simulation represent hairy cells, and the white cells represent smooth cells. So the rules that this embryo seems to follow in terms of its development is that every hairy cell is surrounded only by smooth cells, and each smooth cell has at least one hairy neighbor. Okay, so those are two rules. It's sort of an asymmetric pattern. And then the other rules are that the cells, they have a sort of wild-type differentiated state. They're either hairy or smooth. Okay, so that's the first system. The second system, I'll introduce the three systems and then I'll go back and talk about them in a little more detail. The second system I'll talk about is a bit more complicated. Well, the system isn't as complicated as the frog, but the particular stage in development that we've been studying in the fly is known as cell polarity, how cells in a network achieve their polarity. So there's a fly, there's the fly wing. This is called the Drosophila melanogaster, a fruit fly. That's its wing. And if you zoom in on the wing, so these are wing cells, they also grow hairs. In this case, all of the cells grow little hairs. And the hairs, this is a stylized diagram of the cells on the wing, they always grow from what is called the distal, the side far away from the fly body. So the distal side of the cell, and they point distally. And the question here is the polarity question. How do cells in developing networks determine their polarity? How do they know which is the distal and which is the proximal side? Proximal means close to the fly body. So this is an important question for flies, but the reason people study it is because it's an extremely important question in development of human embryos. It's used all over the place. So in the development of the spine, in the development of the left-right asymmetry of the human body, etc. So understanding cell polarity could help us understand more questions in development. The third system that I'll talk about, and this will be closer to the end of the talk, is on cancer. And this is something where now we're not so interested in the development of the system, we're trying to understand mutations in normal pathways. And this diagram isn't as intuitive as the previous slides, but it's a particular network. It's called the HER2, HER3. This is a human epidermal growth factor. It's a particular gene which is mutated in many cancers. And I'm working with a group that studies breast cancer, and they're trying to understand how this regular circuit is mutated, what's wrong with it in certain breast cancers, because they want to be able to develop drug treatments for it. Okay, so that's an introduction of the three stories. Now I'll go back and spend a little bit of time on each, and then I'll conclude. And I'd like to try to show you the techniques and then kind of come back to the beginning of the talk where I presented mathematical modeling and control and kind of try to close the loop in a figurative sense in the talk. Okay, so we're back to the frog. This is the first story. And so you remember the particular pattern that we talked about in the embryo. And this is, as I said, it's a well-studied system. Biologists have worked on this system, and they've identified that there are two key proteins which are important in the differentiation of the cells in this embryo. The two proteins are called Notch and Delta. Notch is what's called a receptor, and Delta is called its ligand. So I've represented them as kind of not in a stylistic way, as Notch being on one cell and Delta being on another cell, and the binding of those two proteins together, the ligand coming into the receptor, causes some biochemical effects that affect the corresponding genetic networks in the cells and cause the differentiation process from smooth cells to hairy cells. So those proteins don't actually look like that. In fact, these are just fragments of the real Notch and Delta proteins, but they do bind together across the cell membrane. okay, so a model, a mathematical model for the system. We'd like to try to understand how the system, this epithelial network in the frog, robustly produces these patterns of hairs amongst cells that satisfy those rules that I told you about. Every smooth cell has a hairy neighbor, and every hairy cell is only surrounded by smooth cells. And the following, and this is a model in the sense of, we'd call this an influence diagram. The model shows the two proteins, these are two cells next to each other, and so the understanding is that this network is going on in all cells in the network. The two proteins interact, or are proposed to interact, in the following way. Notch inhibits the production of delta in the same cell. That's what this line here means. And delta promotes the production of notch in the neighboring cell. So that's the proposed interaction. So delta, high delta, in high concentrations of delta in one cell promote high concentrations of notch in the neighboring cell. And high concentrations of notch in one cell inhibit the production of delta in the same cell. So it acts kind of like a flip-flop or a switch, this two-protein system. The font size indicates high or low concentration. So if you have high notch, you'd get low delta. If you have low notch, you could get high delta. Okay, so now let's go to the back to the patterns we talked about. Here's a typical pattern. As I said, the cells that are smooth are white. The cells that are hairy are red. We refer to the cells that are smooth as undifferentiated cells, and the cells that are red, the hairy cells, as differentiated cells. Initially, the embryo is all smooth, and then hairs start to grow according to this pattern. It's shown that cells that are undifferentiated have lots of notch and very little delta, and cells that are differentiated have lots of delta and very little notch. So our question turns back to, rather than looking at hairy versus smooth, we're looking at cells that in equilibrium have high delta versus high notch. Okay, so let's build a mathematical model for this system and ask, can we try to understand how the system works, how it robustly produces these patterns that we've seen? Okay, so let's call this cell 1, cell 2, cell 3, and cell 4. This is delta concentration in cell 1, notch concentration in cell 1. So here, delta in cell 1 is large, notch in cell 1 is small. Delta in cell 2 is small, and notch in cell 2 is large. Okay, so we can represent the dynamics of the growth or decay of delta and notch in terms of simple differential equation models. This is an equation that says the change in delta 1 concentration over time is equal to some constant k, which is a positive number, times the concentration of delta 1. Okay, so if you start then with a high concentration of delta, and then you run this differential equation model for that cell, what happens? Well, delta in that cell will start to decrease. It will go down to zero, because this is an exponential decay of delta. It's just saying that this concentration is decaying over time. If we start out with if we use a different model, so now delta in the cell, the change in delta is equal to a proportional term times the concentration of delta plus some positive constant. Then if we start out with an initial concentration of low or zero delta, and we run that differential equation, the concentration of delta will grow over time. Okay, so that's just sort of representing those equations in sort of pictorial form. Okay, so if we wanted to encode that circuit in equations, we could do it the following way. It's a combination of logic, so Boolean logic, with differential equations. If notch in cell 1 is large or high, then delta in cell 1 is going to decay over time. If delta in cell 2 is large, then notch in cell 1 is going to grow over time. Okay, so we encode that. We write a program which, over the network, basically encodes those equations, and then we run it, and we get the wrong answer. Okay, so we get a mutant frog, right? Lots of hairs, lots of hairy cells, packed together. So what are we doing wrong here? What are we missing in this model? And the answer is that there's parameters in that model that we have to identify correctly, namely those constants, the negative k that I talked about, the driving term r, what it means to be high and low in terms of concentration, so the switching thresholds for the logic. And so really, what our group, and in terms of the technology that we've been building in control theory, and we apply this, I mean, we're talking about trying to understand biological systems here, but when we're working on aircraft control systems or collision avoidance systems or robotic maneuvers that we do in my lab, a lot of what we do is this concept of computing controllers using reachability calculations. And the concept of reachability is as follows. In this particular example, it is, let's use a knowledge of what we want, where we want the system to go, to understand constraints on the parameters of the equations such that the model will correctly reproduce the data. Okay, so here's a correct pattern. In the state space of delta and notch concentration, we can consider that to be a region of the state space, meaning that if delta and notch concentrations are in this shaded region, that means that overall in your cell network, you're going to get a pattern that adheres to the correct rules. And now you can backpropagate that under the dynamics of the system. So under those switch differential equations, I'm saying, what states lead to that state? And I can compute those under some conditions on the model. And then I can go backwards again. So those are the states in the state space which correctly lead to the correct equilibrium. And I'm doing these calculations. I can do them analytically for switch linear systems. For nonlinear, typical hybrid systems that we deal with, we have numerical tools that compute these reachable sets. And so on and so on. So basically what we're doing here is we're computing a backwards reachable set. And the boundaries of that set enforce constraints on the parameters of the system so that the model reproduces the data correctly. And so what we end up with is a backwards reachable set which we can use for model identification. On the other side, in the control problems that we work on, we use these backwards reachability tools to design controllers which guarantee certain properties about the system. So this is, in a sense, model checking in the computer-aided verification literature, where designing controllers in an engineered system that has that enforces guarantees on the behavior of the closed-loop system. And here we're just turning the problem around and using it for system identification in biology. These are some backwards reachable sets in three dimensions for that delta notch system. And so if you actually could do this computation for the delta notch system, you can derive constraints on the parameters, the thresholds and the parameters, so that you will always get the correct patterns. Okay, so this is a very simple system. I only had two proteins. There's way more proteins in the cells, the epithelial cells of these frogs. So it's a very simplified, stylized system. So now, in the remaining few minutes of the talk, let me just show you how we've been applying this technique to more complicated systems. All right, so of course, if you follow the rules, you get the correct frog embryo, which gives you the correct frog. Okay, so the second story, fly development. And I should say that whereas the frog work, we were getting all of our data and all of our sort of models and the influence model from papers, from collated sort of, we looked at the literature and used other people's research. In the next two projects, they represent collaboration. So Jeff Axelrod, he's a biologist in the Stanford University School of Medicine. He and I have been collaborating for 10 years. He's an experimental biologist that has a fly lab, and he wants to understand planar cell polarity, and I've been working with him on the mathematical modeling. Okay, and just down here, I mentioned very briefly about the reason one would want to study cell polarity. There are some very serious human diseases that are a result of mutations in cell polarity. Okay, so this problem of polarity, over the course of the past 20 years, there's a fairly large community of biologists working on polarity and in different organisms, and they've discovered that there are four key proteins. So as opposed to the two notch delta, we now have at least four that are going to be included in our model. We're not going to go through the details of these, but they have kind of interesting names, disheveled, frizzled, Prickle and Van Gogh. Typically the lab that discovers a protein gets the honor of naming that protein. So it's a very interesting kind of numerology of the names of proteins. And the interesting thing in this system, so here we're back to our fly wing, is that if you mutate some of these proteins, then you see a propagation of the effect in the healthy cells neighboring the mutation. So polarity is reversed in cells which are either distal or proximal to the mutated cells. And that's interesting from a control theoretic point of view, especially if you're interested in multi-agent systems. If we view each cell as its own dynamic system, then this is indicative of information from the mutant cells being passed to the healthy cells, and we want to try to understand that information. And biologists who'd worked on this, when they saw these results, they thought, well, this is indicative of diffusible proteins. Rather, we thought it was information, and others thought it was proteins that were diffusing to the neighboring cells from the mutant cells. And over the course of the past 10 years, we've basically, with mathematical modeling and experiment, validated the hypothesis that the information passing proposal does explain the system. So the hypothesis is that initially these core proteins are distributed homogeneously throughout the cell cytoplasm and membrane. And over the course of the PCP mechanism working, they distribute asymmetrically. So disheveled and frizzled localize to the distal side, prickle localizes to the proximal side, and the hair grows wherever disheveled is localized highest. If you remove frizzled, you see the effect of that. So you see this, what's called a non-autonomous effect distal to the clone. If you remove prickle or Van Gogh, you see the effect proximal to the clone. So again, here we're back to an influence diagram. My collaborator, Jeff, had proposed this influence diagram, and he published it, and there was a huge amount of controversy in the community as to whether or not that was correct. And so there was sort of supporting experiments, but still many possibilities. They said nothing so simple could describe the complicated behavior. And that's when we came in, and we built over the course of many years, so we went through several iterations of this, and actually the influence diagram changed over the course of this. We built again a differential equation model of that system, coded it up, and again, we did the reachable calculations here numerically and computed a parameterized model which reproduced all of the data. So you see in the simulation the proteins localizing to the correct sides, but you can also see a nice reproduction of the clonal behavior, so the distal and proximal non-autonomy that's been seen. Now that's not convincing enough. What is convincing is then if you can use this model for predictive purposes. And so we used it to predict behaviors of mutations in the loop. So if you overexpress prickle, this inhibition indicates that you may see less disheveled at the membrane. What actually happens, so the model predicts that you see more disheveled at the membrane, and if you do the experiment, it matches. So non-intuitive effects of this feedback loop are reproduced in the model, as well as it helped us understand certain mutant effects in the system. So we were able to explain some unexplained behavior of certain alleles or different versions of proteins using this model and then validate them in experiment. And now what I'd like to do is very briefly complete the talk with the third story, which is now a problem in cancer, helping to understand cancer pathways using this technology of mathematical modeling combined with control theory and reachable set calculations. So again, this is very non-intuitive, but it is a cancer pathway. Here's the boundary of a cell. These HER2 and HER3 are receptors. When ligands bind to them, they activate a pathway, and if, in particular, if some of these components like AKT are high, those are growth proteins, so cancerous cells tend to grow more and more. So typically, drugs for cancer try to deactivate these kind of growth proteins. What was happening, though, and this is a work by Mark Moasser, he's at UCSF, at the medical school. he did some experiments to show that if you use, there's a very popular drug for HER2-positive breast cancer, which is called lapatinib. What it does is it binds to HER2 and deactivates it, and deactivates things down the pathway. And it was a kind of one of these wonder drugs. It worked in about 60% of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. And it was much better than standard chemotherapy, which just tries to kill everything. But in about 30 or 40% of the patients, it didn't work. And what meant is that you got to see some local inhibition, so local meaning over time, for the first 24 hours it worked. And then after about 2 days, the activity came back, and it came back stronger than before. So the question was, in these percentages of women patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, why wasn't this drug working well? And this time process indicated that it was something with the dynamics of the system. We don't understand the dynamics of this network because a lot of the network is still hypothesized. Based on some experiments, so this experimental data, we built a model for the system. We've actually developed a number of different types of models for this. So this kind of hybrid model that I talked about earlier, which combines logic with differential equations. But the one that I'm just going to briefly mention today is this third one, which is a simplified ordinary differential equation model. And again, our goals are as before, that we create a model and we learn parameters from data, we draw hypotheses and test them. If we're successful, we keep on this loop. If we're unsuccessful, we ask why, and we go back and change the model. This is a simplified diagram of the ordinary differential equation model. It looks like an influence diagram. Basically each of these arrows are represented by differential equations. And this model, we again identified parameters using reachability type tools, and then we're able, these are just traces of the model over time, showing the slow increase of the, in particular, AKT after an initial inhibition by this drug. So that matches the data that I showed you earlier. So this is the undesired effect of the drug. It turns out that if you overexpress AKT, so if you have a way to initially make AKT concentration very high in those cells, which is very counterintuitive to cancer specialists because you're trying to make the thing that makes cell grow, typically you're trying to make AKT low. But if you initially treat the cells so you make AKT high, then the cells become seemingly much more receptive to the lapatinib treatment, to this wonder drug. And this was inspired by the model. So we studied the dynamics of this ordinary differential equation model, and we showed that if you bring that network to a new dynamic equilibrium where AKT is high, then the cell becomes much more receptive to the inhibition at the receptor level. So that was something that came out after about a couple of years of working on this different forms of the model. And it led to this idea of a treatment scheme, that we're steering the state of the cells to a new equilibrium, in which we initially bump up AKT and then treat it with the standard drug. And as a control theorist, I mean, I don't know how many of you work in this area of mathematical modeling and control, but this is a very kind of intuitive steering problem. You use your control parameters to try to steer the system to a new equilibrium, rather than just treating with a constant value of a drug. So it goes back to the idea of a steering problem with feedback. So we applied this treatment scheme in simulation, and of course everything always works in simulation. That's what's great about models and simulation. But over the past year we've been, and actually my students who are electrical engineers and mechanical engineers are working in the lab with our collaborators' students. They learned the lab techniques, and we did a number of experiments. And here are the preliminary ones. I mean, now we're publishing this, but if you just treat with lapatinib, the percent of apoptosis, that's the number of cells that die at the end of this treatment, is about 11%. If you use the scheme in which you pre-treat with something that increases AKT, and then you hit the cells with lapatinib, you get a much higher percentage of apoptosis. And this was an initial experiment where the treatment wasn't exactly what we prescribed, so we've gone through a number of iterations. This is the latest data that we just got in the past month, that so these are different time points, and I'm just showing you a slice of the data, but this is no pre-treatment, and this is pre-treatment at the same time period.
And then for each of those, you have to do a control. So you either do lapatinib or you do a control, so to be able to get the experiment right. And you can see that, you know, even in the case of uncertainty, so statistical variation in the cells, that you do much better in apoptosis when you use this pretreatment with AKT. Okay, so let me summarize the talk. I think that one of the points I wanted to get across here is really the use of mathematical modeling in a fairly non-traditional way, which is trying to understand the behavior of biological cell networks. And really what we've been doing is trying to choose, we're not sort of coming in with a tool or a model in mind, we always try to choose the best model that adequately represents the system and the questions that we're trying to ask about the system. And then in each of these systems, so the frog embryo was really an illustrative example, but in the two other systems, we're actively working on the research. So now in the PCP system, we're currently trying to understand, it's clear that development is a modular system. There's a module which initially produces an initial asymmetry that the module that robustifies this, that we studied, then reads. So we're now going back a step and trying to understand the developmental module that sets up the global asymmetric cue. In the cancer project, we're further probing this this idea of signal buffering. That's the idea of pre-treating with AKT to get the system to a new equilibrium. We're developing models for different mutations of the cells. And all the experiments, they're not done on, they're done on what are called cell lines. These are immortalized cells taken from patients with different kinds of breast cancer. And we're increasing the level of detail in the models. And in the experimental work, we've got, as I said, our model developers are in the wet lab learning and getting some appreciation for the experiments. And we're doing a lot of work in the verification and validation of the models on the actual cell lines and now in mice experiments. So with that, I'd like to conclude and thank all of my collaborators. And our work is funded by the National Institute of Health, the National Cancer Institute within that group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Clara, for an absolutely fascinating talk. I find it really intriguing how, you know, relatively simple mathematical models inspired by control theory can actually lead to predictions in biological systems and can actually be exploited to develop new kinds of treatments. I find that absolutely fascinating. So there is going to be a small, we only have a couple of minutes for questions and answers, but Claire will be around in the Science Cafe, so for whoever would like to discuss with her afterwards is welcome to take that opportunity as well. But now maybe we can take time for one or two questions if from the floor. Over there? Yeah, okay, is there a microphone? Like there in the middle?
Yeah, I just would like to pose one question about model selection, because, I mean, your models have been relatively simple in a sense, and of course they are in a certain sense for sure shortcuts of more complex mathematical models. So how do you, how do you choose the models? I mean, it's not only the reachability is something you do later, but what is really your, you know, how do you select the model? That's a very important point.
I don't think there's a good answer in terms of exactly how to do this, but we do it based on the questions that are being posed about the system. So as an example, with the cell polarity system, that is a system, the model that we have is 10 partial differential equations with 37 parameters. So it's small, but it's still kind of, you know, fairly large in the sense of what typically we deal with in control theory or aerodynamics. We chose that model because of all of our data was at the level of, we didn't measure individual molecule position. We measured through these fluorescence. We were using basically microscopic fluorescence, so we could measure the data that we had was measuring concentrations, or actually relative concentrations of proteins. So then we knew that we were probably going to have a model in which the signals, the state variables, were concentrations of proteins, and we had a few samples over time. It's very expensive to do these experiments, so we, over a 12-hour period, we had about 4 samples. So that gave us some indication of what our state variables should be. And again, the interaction diagram was proposed. So we encoded that interaction diagram the simplest way we could, using the least number of assumptions. Namely, we used a reaction diffusion type model. Diffusion was the only mechanism we encoded initially for motion of molecules, because we didn't know if there was active transport, and we felt that if the model worked for diffusion, it would only be easier in the future to modify it to get it to work for active transport, which provides some bias to the motion. So there were a number of decisions that were kind of developed over time. It was clear that we couldn't use a simple, like a switched linear differential equation model for that PCP system, which would have been even simpler, because that doesn't really answer the question that we were trying to sort of convince biologists that this was a plausible representation of the system. Namely, we had to have something that was a little closer to a biological description of the system, rather than, say, just switched fluxes, which a linear differential equation switching between different modes would enable. So I think that question is really a deep one, and it's really, I don't think there's a right or wrong way, but it's usually based on what your data is and what questions you're trying to answer about the system.
Okay, thank you very much. We probably have to end the discussion here, and as I mentioned before, Claire will be available at the Science Cafe for further discussion. So thank you again for a fascinating talk.